Greetings and welcome, all you critical thinkers out there. This is Throttle Up, and this is a radio show and soon to be podcast that showcases critical thinking and is designed to do four things. First thing we say that is designed to inform and to keep us critically engaged in what is actually going on. The second thing is to delimit our thinking. We want to delimit ourselves and not to think in conventional terms. So I guess you could say that we are emphasizing, and we all ought to emphasize, non-conventional thinking. The third thing is to empower all of us to use our power of reason. Now, our power of reason, we propose, is the most powerful thing in the known universe, and so we should not disregard it or diminish it. We should see it as something quite profound, something as a gift that we all have, and so we should use it and not squander it or give it away to somebody else. And the fourth thing is to amaze. Now, I know that you say, amaze, what does that mean, Kevin? Well, it basically means that if we employ critical thinking, you're going to be amazed at how effective it truly is and how we can improve our power of reason quite effectively and quite easily. I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired. Now, I'm a naval aviator, and of course, I've been working in this area for a very long time. What is this area? This area that we generally call critical thinking, but also it goes by a number of other names, not necessarily cover all of them, but critical thinking and higher order reasoning are the things that I guess I could hang my hat on and say that I've been a pioneer in this field, worked in it for a very long period of time, have a lot of things that I have done and a lot of things that I have contributed to this body of knowledge. And we cover them from time to time. This is not necessarily a show about me exclusively, but it is a show about all of us. And it's basically a show about you and how you can improve your power of reasoning to do things that you don't really think you can do, but I'm going to say that you can. Our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary, and our motto is to employ high-velocity reason to achieve high-octane performance. Now, we have a mission statement for the show, but I'm going to modify that from time to time. So, as we get more involved in this whole issue of critical thinking and complex problem-solving, our mission, basically, is to explain in a coherent, in a understandable way, what exactly do we mean by critical thinking and complex problem solving? Why do we need it? Under what conditions or circumstances is it needed? And then how do we use it? How do we employ those cognitive mechanisms and cognitive attributes to do those things? And for what purpose? Do we have a purpose in mind? Are we trying to achieve something? In other words, what is our mission? So our mission statement for this show is to thoroughly explain what we mean by critical thinking and complex problem solving. And how do we use it, and under what conditions should it absolutely be used? All right. And those are quite surprised at the fact that there are going to be conditions or situations that you may very well encounter that will require you to think critically and to solve complex problems, or to engage the complex problem-solving algorithms. Otherwise, you will not be successful. So So ultimately, we want to achieve mission success. And that's what we're trying to do on our show. Now, our website is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. And the audio engineering services for the show is provided by Evergreen Studios. And they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, which is right outside of Denver in the foothills. It's in the western foothills or west of the city of Denver. Rather delightful place and a great group of folks. Enjoy working with them. Also, promotional material for this show and related subjects and events is provided by Reflections Printing and Purveyors of Standout Handouts. The key principal there is a gal by the name of Jennifer, and she has been quite helpful over the years. Her phone number, if anybody wants to get some promotional material going for whatever you're trying to do, could be anything, e-commerce, website, radio show like this, you name it. It is something that we all need from time to time. Their phone number is 435-574-0422. That's 435-574-0422. Jennifer is the gal. She's the best in the business. And if you need help in this area, I would suggest you give her a call. Okay, so the whole idea behind this show is to address ourselves to what has recently been reported and discovered by me is the Future of Jobs report. Now, this report is published, I guess, periodically by the World Economic Forum, and they predict, now this is quite incredible, they predict that by the year 2020, critical thinking and complex problem solving will be the most in-demand set of skills in the global job market, but also the hardest to recruit for. The show is organized, typically the show is organized into three parts. Now, this show is actually intended to be a special edition of Throttle Up. And so it's not going to follow the standard format necessarily, although it's going to be following generally the standard format. But it is, in fact, a special edition. And then the reason for that is that it became clear to me that we need to have some kind of a meaningful discussion about some historical events that have occurred in this country, and in particular, the Vietnam War. And the reason for that is a couple of reasons. Number one is that the National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, is our National Security Advisor in the Trump administration. He's an Army Lieutenant General. Now, he wrote a book recently, and it's called Dereliction of Duty. And it basically is a rather thoroughgoing and a very effective treatment on this this era that or this situation that the United States encountered somewhere in the late 60s and early 70s. Now, we call it the Vietnam War. It's also called, more accurately, the Second Indochina War. And his book is rather insightful, and I think it's probably ought to be required reading for anybody who wants to understand how the United States ought to consider such an event and what's going on in terms of how people are thinking within the current Trump administration with respect to national security. All right, so again, this is a special edition of Throttle Up. It's going to be a thoroughgoing, it's going to be a discussion of this Vietnam war situation. And also, not only because Lieutenant General McMaster wrote a book about it from a strategic standpoint, but also because of my experience as a naval officer and a naval aviator during this period of time. And I was, in fact, involved in this a particular conflict in a rather significant way. And so because of those two things, we're going to have this special edition. Now, I actually don't know. I don't know if it's going to be a single show or it might be a series of shows. Right now, we've got quite a bit of ground to cover, but it may very well be a series of shows. We'll see how it goes. All right. I'll try to make that assessment after this and see how much ground we have covered and what needs to be covered. And so anyway, all aboard the Throttle Up Express, and we will be discussing in a moment this this issue that is on the table for us today, which is the issue of the Vietnam War. How should we think about it? Why did we engage ourselves in such a futile enterprise, and what can we learn from it? Is there things that we need to understand objectively and critically, utilizing the lens of critical thinking and complex problem solving? What can we learn from it? And that is all part of the human experience, is to gain understanding about ourselves and our environment and our community and our country, so that we can move forward and progress, not make the same mistakes twice. That hopefully is something that America doesn't do. I would not like to think that we would get embroiled in another dumb thing like this. And so, well, again, we'll look at it from a critical thinking standpoint. We're not going to be we're not going to be accusing a lot of people and singling out people as, you know, as particularly dumb thinkers, although there were a fairly large number of folks that we would consider to be dumb thinkers. Anyway, so all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where critical thinkers and complex problem solvers are welcome with open arms, and where America finds solutions. Now let's press on to this special edition of Throttle Up. Welcome back to, this is a special edition of Throttle Up. The special edition of Throttle Up is, from time to time, we do special editions, and these are particularly important subjects that I think would be of interest and have enduring interest throughout the years. And so we have these special editions that are intended for a place, hopefully in everybody's library, because all of these will be part of a podcast set. And we will preserve them as such. And so, and also we will be broadcasting these periodically throughout the year, during times where it's important, also during times where I'm not available to do a particular weekly show. And so sometimes we will substitute that for, or these special editions for that situation. All right, so this is about the Vietnam War, also known as the Second Indochina War, and the lessons that it should teach all of us. Now, this treatment is going to be non-conventional. It also is going to be primarily firsthand. So you're getting, I'm going to be reporting what I would call firsthand knowledge, because I was there. You could say that been there, done that for me, Captain Smith. And so a lot of the stuff that I will be talking about will be hopefully insightful. It's also will be firsthand, and so you can recognize it as coming from a credible source. First thing that we need to understand is this: to understand the Vietnam War or the engagements, the military engagements that we conducted in this Indochina, if you will, if we want to understand it strategically, we first need to understand the post-World War II geopolitical configuration of the world, and this is important, and the bifurcation of the world into two major camps. One is the countries that embraced capitalism, or some version of it, some form of capitalism, and two, countries that embraced communism, or some form of communism. I say that with a note of caution. Most countries did not have their own version of communism, though the version of communism was dictated to them by some Supreme Council, with the notable exception of Yugoslavia. But more fundamentally, we should think of this as how, well here's the question. Here's the fundamental question. And I've mentioned this before in some of my shows. This is, how should humans organize themselves as they become industrialized? In other words, what does the modern industrial society look like? What should it look like? In other words, not only what does it look like, but what should it look like? Now, some people would say that it should look like a communist society, and they say that for various reasons that they put forward. And then other people will say, well, it should look like a capitalistic society, or a society that embraces a free market enterprise and private property. Okay, so those are two polar opposite ideas of how humans should organize themselves. So understanding that going forward. Now, also, this thing that we call communism, where did it come from? It just didn't spontaneously emerge from the ether. Communism emerged as a direct result of the Industrial Revolution and its perceived shortcomings. Now, I say that again with caution. Not all observers thought that capitalism was defective. Only some. Some observers, for example, Karl Marx and others of his ilk and era, saw capitalism as defective. Capitalism with respect to the Industrial Revolution. Now, the Industrial Revolution began in Great Britain in about the early 1700s and lasted until about the mid-1800s. And, of course, it continues, but this is not the first or the original Industrial Revolution. Other industrial-type revolutions have occurred. Some people say that we are now entering into the fourth industrial revolution. And we've covered that before. I'm not going to get into that in great detail now. But the original or the initiating industrial revolution occurred first in Great Britain and involved textiles, transportation, manufacturing, harnessing of energy, and so forth. And it went through major transformations. Modern industrial societies became quite wealthy, especially due to trade. Now, against this backdrop, many philosophers viewed industrialization in negative terms. I'm not even sure why that is. I don't know why, because industrialization helped so many people. Anyway, they did, in which they were understood humanity to belonging to one of two major classes. And they saw class struggle to be central to the human condition. In particular, Marx, Engels, and others emphasized class affiliation and the attendant struggle of the proletariat, that is, the workers, if you will, or proletariat actually means those without property. And they wanted the proletariat, those that did not own property, to escape bondage. They consider them to be in bondage. Human bondage It was assumed by the critics of industrialization to be a predominant feature of the private ownership of the means of production, and that class struggle will eventually do away with this modern form of slavery, where the workers will assume their rightful place as co-owners of the means of production, or at least that's what they thought. Now, we begin to see that this whole idea had aspects of utopianism to it. This thing started to take on a version of, I guess you would say, maximum wishful thinking, and it eventually started to crumble in terms of its intellectual rigor. Nevertheless, it did affect a lot of people over the years. So, the inheritors of the nation's wealth, who are they that should enjoy the wealth of a nation? That was the big question of the day. Now, the communists thought that the nation's wealth should be confiscated from that which is held privately and redistributed to those who are most in need. In other words, to confiscate private property, make it public, and to redistribute the property to those most in need. The motto of communism, and we all have heard this, I cringe when I hear this, and I will cringe now as I say it, but nevertheless, it has to be stated. The motto of communism is that the redistribution of wealth takes on the form from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. Taking it to its logical conclusion, this nonsensical motto assumes that the able will always possess an excess of resources, and that the inable, or those unable to do something, will always be without. But those that are unable to do things are perpetually worthy of the fruits of the labor of someone else. The reason for this intrinsic worthiness is really never explained in the body of knowledge, or the body that we call communism. It's not really not, I'm sorry about using that word knowledge. I would say it's more propaganda than knowledge. Nevertheless, this intrinsic worthiness is never really explained beyond some ill-defined notion of sentimentality and compassion. In other words, those that have abundance and experience prosperity should feel guilty, and those that are destitute and without should expect that others will provide, not needing to provide for oneself. Now, the reference here to a lot of this stuff is on what we call international communism. There's a good reference book. It's called A Brief History of Communism. It's published by Oxford University Press. I would recommend it for anyone's library or digital library. Again, it's an easy read. It's not a overly complex or difficult thing to get through, and it's intended to be a brief history, and they do a pretty good job at it. The first installation of a countrywide communist form of government was Russia in 1917, according to this source and others. The result of the October Revolution, but this term is a misnomer. Russia was already experiencing a period of turmoil and instability and was already in a revolutionary state of affairs. The Second Revolution of 1917 brought about communism under the leadership of Vladimir Lenin. Now, Lenin was a known revolutionary and was living in exile in Switzerland when Germany, get this, when Germany resurrected him from oblivion and sent him clandestinely to Russia as their agent. The idea being that Lenin would lead the second revolution of 1917, take over the reins of power from the inept, and in the process create a puppet German state, allowing Germany to win the First World War. Everything went according to plan. Lenin took over the Russian government through revolutionary means with a promise of a better life for the peasants. Except one thing did not go according to plan. Lenin did not become a pawn of Germany. Instead, began a crusade of global communism with Russia as the center of this movement. Okay, we are going to take a short break. We will continue with this special edition shortly. Okay, welcome back to this special edition of Throttle Up. And the special edition is intended to discuss, from a critical thinking standpoint, the thing we call the Vietnam War, also known as the Second Indochina War. Now, continuing our discussion, up until 1917, communism was known mainly as a theoretical construct made popular in some quarters by Karl Marx and his writings and others. But since Marx was never involved in the actual implementation of communism, much of his ideas were vague and of dubious logic. Nevertheless, Russia became communist and was able to survive World War II intact, since Germany's second attempt to take over Russia failed as well. The secret meeting, now this is important to understand the rise of communism. The secret meeting held between Churchill and Stalin after World War II, known as the Treaty of Proportionality, ensured that Russia would become a world power and be able to annex a huge swath of Europe. A firm conviction was held by Lenin and presumably Stalin that Russia was the vanguard. Russia, or soon to be the USSR, was the vanguard of global communism, and it was their duty and responsibility to make sure that communism enjoyed global expansion. Thus, as was true in Eastern Europe and Asia, including China, Indochina became a focus of communist expansion. Capitalizing on the failed French Indochina policy, North Vietnam began a campaign of insurgency with respect to all of Vietnam, intending to create a greater communist Vietnam, which of course they eventually did. Massive aid was necessary and was provided for by communist Russia and the newly formed communist China, with China, for example, committing 320,000 Chinese to the cause. Global communism was on the march, and Vietnam was next, not least of which were its large peasant population, which was important, which was for the communist easy to radicalize. Russia, as the vanguard of global communism, was now still possible, as envisioned by Lenin, but was delayed since Western Europe remained profoundly disinterested in this movement, but perhaps they thought Indochina was now ready. Okay, so with the Korean debacle still fresh in their minds, international communism, headquartered in the USSR, moved quickly to establish a communist insurgency in Indochina, headquartered in North Vietnam and placing their puppet Ho Chi Minh as head of the movement. Ho Chi Minh, by the way, was not his real name and was very likely a trained revolutionary starter and a member of the International Communist Movement. Combat operations with respect to this war, which we call the Vietnam War, or combat operations for the Second Indochina War, one and the same thing. They lasted somewhere in the vicinity of 1963 to 1973. So about 10 years, not exactly that long, but well, for our purposes here, we can say that those are reasonable dates. And sometime in the area of 1963, U.S. advisors who were already there helping the French, U.S. advisors morphed into combat troops on or about 1963. Consequently, the United States was engaged in combat operations, for better or worse, from about 1963 to 1973, in which they accomplished nothing of value. Committing American resources, America's best and brightest, to combat without clearly defined strategic and tactical goals was unbelievably stupid. Now, to bring in this book I was talking about, just as a reminder as we go forward, Lieutenant General McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty, is important here. So these are not just my thoughts, although I will give you my thoughts because I was involved in this. But Lieutenant General McMaster has also his thoughts too. I don't really want to put words in his mouth, but I think you can see that I'm trying to come to grips with this rather depressing state of affairs. That is our part of our history, and to make some sense of it. Now, it cost America more than 50,000 killed in action, many more wounded, and civilian casualties mounted as the subsequent purges by communist forces exceeded somewhere in the vicinity of 2 to 3 million people in Vietnam only. All right, now we will move on to the air campaign. And the air campaign is something that I was involved with directly. And it also is important to cover from that perspective because it has broader meaning than what a lot of people consider. It has broader meaning in terms of a lot of things that we need to understand and to consider as we go forward as a nation. Be right back. Welcome back to this special edition. Let us consider now the air campaign from a critical thinking perspective. So the air campaign in Vietnam was conducted in mostly in North, or of course, North and South Vietnam, but predominantly you're going to be talking about the air campaign in North Vietnam. And what was going on? Why did things happen the way they did? And what are the lessons that we can learn from such a thing? So let's press on with this, and let's look at it through the lens of critical thinking. After the Korean War, when it became obvious that the United States could no longer downsize its military due to the threat from international communism, a massive buildup of force capability was undertaken by the Pentagon. And as such, we entered the period commonly known as the Cold War. This force buildup centered on technology, and for the Air Force and the Naval Air Arm, high technology became the major driver. Those of us, like myself, that opposed such a single-minded approach were ridiculed. Indeed, Colonel John Boyd, U.S. Air Force, I've mentioned him before on my shows, He proposed that the military should consider ideas first, then people, and finally technology in that order of priority. This was ignored. It was determined by war planners that close in air combat, for example, was a thing of the past, soon to be replaced by sophisticated airborne radars and missiles capable of longer range lethality. To get such systems airborne, a large nose cone housing the radar was required, as well as a dedicated weapon system operator and numerous missile holding devices called missile rails, all of which added weight and degraded aerodynamic performance of these airborne vehicles. The cost of high technology airborne tactical systems was considerable, but the United States figured that it could handle this cost burden. I'm not sure that that turned out to be true, but at the time that they thought that they could. The cost was considerable to get these airplanes employed operationally. The extra weight of the aircraft was the limiting factor. They were also limited by internal fuel capacity, requiring high drag drop tanks. They required a dedicated weapon system operator. They also had reduced maneuverability because of the weight and other restrictions. Lower reliability because these high-tech systems were not particularly reliable, and, of course, higher maintenance load. Nevertheless, highly advanced missile platforms were procured in large numbers for the U.S. Air Force and Navy, which began with the introduction of the F-4 Phantom II in about 1960. As a footnote, I do not wish to degrade the aircraft designed as true high-speed interceptors, such as the F-102 and F-106. These were excellent aircraft for their intended mission, which was high-speed interceptor. Now, the F-4 Phantom II entered the Vietnam War as a long-range interceptor with crews trained exclusively in this mission. This proved to be a complete disaster, since the command of the skies required the defeat of the Soviet-provided and Soviet-maintained MiG-21, a formidable adversary. After experiencing unacceptable losses as a result of MiG-21 encounters, which some or many having been flown by Soviet pilots, I know that's hard to believe, but it's true, the Navy went into panic mode, commissioning a major inquiry into the reasons for the unacceptably high tactical failure rate. They also purchased through the State Department an actual MiG-21. This was flown against all Navy and Air Force fighter aircraft. Now, this was a serious effort, and the first American pilot to fly the Soviet MiG-21 fishbed was now Captain Bill Kuiper, U.S. Navy, and a good friend of mine. Test results revealed that aircraft that against a small, lightweight fighter, like the MiG-21, particularly of this design, American-built aircraft performed poorly, all except for one. This one was referred to as the last of the gunfighters and was built as a contemporary of the much larger and heavier F-4 Phantom, but was utilized on the smaller carriers in which the Phantom was too heavy. So fortunately, we did have an aircraft that could perform, if properly flown, could perform quite well against the MiG-21 threat in Vietnam. This aircraft was the F-8 Crusader. And by the way, that's the aircraft that I flew as a naval aviator. And was the air and possessed the aerodynamic performance, or a better way of saying that is it replicated the aerodynamic performance of the MiG-21 quite well. But it was, in fact, superior to the MiG-21 in a number of key areas, such as sustained turn rate and speeds above 550 knots. So that brings us to the era of Top Gun, and we will explain that shortly. Welcome back to this special edition of Throttle Up. And this special edition is about the Vietnam War, and this particular section is about the era of Top Gun. Now, Top Gun, which is a phrase made popular by the movie of the same name, became formalized in the late 1960s or early 70s. I think it's probably somewhere in the vicinity of 1968 or 1969, if my memory serves me. This is the result of the combat crew's poor performance during the active air campaign in Vietnam, as well as simulated wartime conditions. Technology was supposed to provide the force multiplier, and the human operator, the flight crews, were supposed to operate the technology. Efforts to introduce such things as energy and resource management were considered too touchy-feely and were rejected. So, maneuver warfare then became central to many of us who were thinking outside the box. Maneuver warfare was a thing that was way outside the box, but it was made popular by Colonel John Boyd and others. Maneuver warfare was also rejected, on different grounds, right? So it was presented and rejected initially. And this being that close individual range combat maneuvering, this was considered no longer necessary due to technological advancements. Consequently, maneuver warfare as a distinct combat discipline was either de-emphasized or ignored entirely. Top Gun did not erupt spontaneously upon the air combat scene, but emerged from a series of grassroots initiatives that, in one way or another, attempted to address maneuver warfare. Maneuver warfare employed aspects of deception, agility, adaptability, and velocity and energy, as well as complexity. All of these were intellectual concepts that were, surprisingly, outside the technological silo that existed at the time and that still exists today. The airborne version of maneuver warfare made popular by Colonel John Boyd is called air combat maneuvering, or ACM. During the Vietnam era, a crash course was given to all future combat crews. Subsequent to about 1968-1979, that stressed maneuver warfare and how to achieve mission success in this arena. Okay, so before we get on to the next section here, let me summarize our thinking so far. Here we have the United States embroiled in the Second Indochina War for various and sundry reasons, not any of which made a whole lot of sense. But let's say that the United States, to be kind, to be kind, we could say the United States was, you know, was concerned about what they call the domino theory, or concerned about the march of global communism. Okay, that's fine, and I would have been too, and I was, because I was there. I was concerned about that. I think that it was a legitimate concern, right? I'm not sure that we really understood the lessons learned, or should have learned, that we should have learned from Korea. Nevertheless, there was some feeling of unease. There were some concerns about global communism, because China had recently gone communistic. Southeast Asia, certainly Indochina, certainly in large parts of course, Russia and large parts of Eastern Europe were now under communist domination. Okay, so that became a real concern. That's fair enough. And we tried to understand it from a regional standpoint in Indochina. What should the United States do? What can it do with respect to communism attempting to get a foothold in Indochina? All right, so we began by putting in advisors. What the heck that means, I'm not even sure. Nevertheless, that morphed into active combat troops. So we began an active combat operation in North and South Vietnam for a long period of time. And eventually, we essentially gave up. We did not truly understand why we were there. What was our end game? What was our goals? What was our mission objectives? And what was our overall purpose for being there? Could we, in fact, thwart the expansion of global communism? Should it be done there? Was it done there? And so forth and so on. None of these things were a major part of our national discourse. The Vietnam War taught me and I hopefully many others that we were mostly embroiled in minutia. We didn't really see the big picture. We didn't understand the big picture. Didn't even know what the big picture ought to look like, and we didn't even know what the big picture actually did look like. And so we became quite dumbfounded, and we became quite stupid, and we showed the pressing and dire need for more critical thinking from our national leadership, or critical thinking at the national level, which we did not have. The situation has not improved dramatically since then. We still don't have a lot of critical thinking at the national level. All right, so that's where we're going with this. So as we proceed on to the next area, we're going to call this next segment complexity management. And this isn't in regard to the air campaign in Vietnam, what we can understand from it. And from my standpoint, it quickly became apparent that the air combat arena was extremely complex, and that some mechanism was urgently needed to provide for complexity management. But since, as humans living in a modern industrial society, complexity management and complexity theory was not, at that time, a subject of serious inquiry. We had to bootstrap this important aspect of training and cognition. Now, this is where performance modeling was born. Now, I know that most people don't know this. I would say that most academicians will not believe this, but this is true. This is where performance modeling was born. And what is performance modeling? Well, those performance modeling. Well, before I get into that, I remember, this is a personal anecdote here. I remember presenting a mission performance model for air transport operations after I became an airline pilot to a senior group of senior officials at the FAA. And these people were academically trained. And, of course, it was rejected. Now, however, everyone is talking about and emphasizing the use of models and algorithms. Anyway, so a key aspect of critical thinking for operators and managers is the employment of models and algorithms to gain an improved level of comprehension of the dynamics of the situation. This is true now. And this was true and is true in this air combat arena. System dynamics is now an area of formal inquiry, first made popular by J.W. Forrester, and considers such things as agility, adaptability, velocity, and stability. The dynamics of an air combat operation are quite difficult to understand without first acquiring an understanding of mission dynamics and complexity. Creating mental models of rapidly changing dynamic environments are necessary in order to solve problems in this domain. Now, this, as we come to the conclusion of this special edition, this was the missing ingredient. The missing ingredient was these cognitive attributes, if you will, or we didn't understand that this whole aspect of air combat was in fact the engagement of a cognitive system. So the cognitive system had to be able to think clearly and solve complex problems. And how do you do that? And so Top Gun was born to address itself to this dynamic environment. We call it maneuvering, or maneuver warfare, to be more accurately. And how do you perform in this environment? How do you employ maneuver warfare? Well, you just don't go out there and try to do it without preparing yourself in the way of cognitive capabilities and cognitive attributes and cognitive mechanisms. We need to be able to figure out how we can best set ourselves up from a cognitive standpoint, how we can set ourselves up to perform well in this particular environment. And so that was the whole idea behind what we tried to do in the early years of Top Gun, in the early years of air combat training. How can we reverse the rather depressing performance that we had initially in this Vietnam War with respect to air warfare? And so a lot of the things that have been learned, the lessons learned from this, now we are utilizing them in other domains and other areas to help all of us perform better, particularly in complex environments and complex situations. Okay, I see I'm coming up to the end of the show, and I guess we're going to be having another session of another special session here, because we need a little bit more time to conclude this discussion of the Vietnam War and the lessons learned thereof. And so until next time, thank you all for tuning in, listening to Throttle Up, and we will be with you next week.